Hello, my name is Father Deacon Maverick, and this is my podcast, The Ecumenist Tank. I hope you enjoy this episode with me.
Welcome to The Ecumenist Tank. My name is Father Deacon Maverick, and I am the host here on The Ecumenist Tank, where we speak about various issues as it relates to Christian unity, especially in areas of theology, philosophy, and social issues. We also have other related issues like interreligious talk that I will hopefully deal with in the future. And I mean, there's several people that I want to get on here, but I just don't know when that's going to happen. So sometimes when I record this, I say a lot of stuff and I forget about the things that I want to say, and I end up saying things, you know, grammatically incorrect way, and then I start stressing. And this is the thing that's crazy, guys. It feels like I'm just, you know, coming out of nowhere, but I currently reside in South Korea, and believe it or not, if you are an English speaker in South Korea, there are not many people that you can speak to in English, at least not, you know, fluent English. And then you start, and when you start teaching English, it gets worse. And you're like, is that the way you say that word? And then you start experiencing other English cultures and stuff. And you just feel inadequate on every level. But I'm saying that because I feel like sometimes I don't know how to say basic things anymore. I know how to say things like a child, but I can't say things like an adult, and that sometimes worries me. But anyways, there's been, a lot of things that I wanted to speak about, but I, for some reason, when I start recording, something happens and everything just goes bad. And you know, I was invited by a friend to discuss universalism, and I am not a very good person to refer to on the issue of anything. I am a theology nerd. I'm still studying theology. I have an undergraduate degree in theology. Hopefully, I'll finish up until a master's degree. I don't know if I want to go further than that. Hopefully I'll get that done. And then I don't want to study for a long time. But it seems like, the topic of universalism is popping up again. I should just deal with one thing at a time. But anyways, a friend of mine, he invited me on Telegram to join this group where they were chatting about universalism and stuff, and very nice guys. I'm not going to tell you what their theological affiliations are or what church they belong to or anything like that. I just want to speak about what someone said. There was something that someone said, and I think it was so indicative of, I think, the spiritual sickness that some people find themselves in. And I don't want to pedal lightly on this, and I really want to say it. If you think that the very foundation of a meaningful existence requires eternal conscious torment, that I actually want to say to you that you're probably not approaching this from a very Christian perspective. If anything, think about this. It's like only if there are winners and losers would life make sense. So life is pointless if everyone makes it. Think about that for a moment. I believe that the hope, at least the hope that all will be saved, that all can be saved, is a Christian hope. 1 Timothy 2 says God desires all men to be saved to come to a knowledge of the truth. If God desires all men to be saved, then this is a hope that I would think all Christians should have, right? And to say that if the fulfillment of that hope, to say that the fulfillment of that hope would make life pointless, is to me a very deeply disturbing position to take. It's a disturbing point to make because it isn't a point. It's just a rant about the fact that you don't like the idea of God saving all in the end. And I would really like to challenge anyone listening to this, that if you think that all shall be saved, if you think that that will not happen, or that it should not happen, or that it renders everything about life vacuous or pointless, that I would like to say to you that you cannot be a Christian in any meaningful sense of the word. The Paschal victory of Christ means nothing to you. The price that Jesus paid when he bore our sins in his body, that means nothing to you. The entire Christian narrative becomes nonsensical. So contrary to the claim that we need hell, we need an eternal hell, mind you, to make sense of Christianity, I think it's actually the other way around. Rather, it's more so the case that if you require eternal conscious torment and suffering, that the requirement of that belief is what turns Christianity into a pointless narrative. Think about it. The entire gospel narrative becomes a horror story. There's nothing about universal salvation that requires us to believe that life is pointless, or that life would be pointless if it were true. There's just nothing about it. So what you're saying is it's nothing but a complaint. You know, I was speaking, this is something that came up in a conversation I had with someone. You know, if we are in an environment where we are all headed and focusing on the common good and the common goal of a functional society, if someone is making a mistake, we have two options. We can say, you are doing such and such wrong, you should correct it. If we do that, it's probably more so the case that things are going to get done. But if I turn around and say, well, hey, I don't like that guy, or I don't like the fact that that guy isn't doing the right thing, guess what? That's only going to breed more bitterness. That's only going to breed more anger. That's going to breed in an environment of toxicity. I don't even know if I'm pronouncing it right. But a toxic environment is bound to follow. And I think the same thing can be said of Christian theology when it comes to universalism. If we believe that the vast majority of people should, without exception, if they reject Christ this side of eternity, if you believe that they should go over into everlasting conscious torment, if you believe that they shouldn't be given any second chances, or that God should do away with them and stuff, then I think you've got this whole thing wrong. When people say, well, Maverick is just arguing from emotion, and he's saying is that guy even a minister? You know, all sorts of things. No, I believe that if God is who he says he is, the proposition, and David Ben-Tiat mentions this in his book, That All Shall Be Saved. He says, you know, that's the meaning of creation ex nihilo. And that's actually something that you get in St. Isaac the Syrian's work. Not sure precisely where, but I think it was in something that Metropolitan Ilarion Alfeyev mentioned in his book on the person of St. Isaac the Syrian. He says that God has created all things in love, and the conclusion and the goal to which all things move is love. Being created in love to end in love. And for us to assume that consigning or allowing people to consign themselves to eternal conscious torment is loving is to miss the point. And then we get into all sorts of questions about freedom, libertarian freedom, and so on. Iris Murdoch has a book that David Bentley Hart mentions, and he recommends it, called The Sovereignty of Good. That freedom is defined by the movement towards the good. Freedom, if I jump out of the window, I might be free, so to speak, to jump out of the window, but that is an impediment against who I am, an impediment against my nature. It is not the exercise of true freedom. The only exercise, you know, in which this choice is free is if that very choice is a movement towards the good. And therefore, if someone is not moving towards the good, he is doing something which is, quite frankly, insane. It's something which is bound in ignorance. It is something which is bound in darkness. Jesus said that the truth will set you free. I don't want to go over that because I think David Bentley Hart, and he, you know, he's mentioned that so many times online on several podcasts. You guys can just check David Bentley Hart and the question of free will. Yeah, I just wanted to do that rant. And I just wanted to, I was looking at the deep patristic roots of Hart's universalism, a response to Father Lawrence Farley. That was by Mark Chenoweth. That's on the Eclectic Orthodoxy blog and website. And Mark Chenoweth goes through several patristic sources about Hart's universalism. And yeah, I've said this before. It's quite clearly the case that St. Gregory of Nyssa was a universalist, is a universalist. and there's so much that we can look at. But I think two things that I might not have made clear. It is impossible, and I didn't make this clear, by the way, on the previous episode, that's what I'm referring back to. I don't think it is possible for someone to be complicit in their rejection of God. In other words, I don't think it is possible for someone to eternally be complicit in evil and eternally reject God. And this is something that comes straight from the patristics. Let me just get this up. No, and at the end of the day, I've got to wonder why people are so stuck in believing the idea of infernalism. And you know, Father Al Kimmel, in his book, he mentions the whole debacle with, on the question of the Fifth Ecumenical Council, and I'm not going to go over that, but it's something worth looking at. So I forgot where I put these quotes, because there were some things that I wanted to read. But yeah, I think that it is quite clear that any desire to want to make the church free of universalism or anything like that is an exercise in futility. And I'm not gonna be long on this. I just want to kind of get through this. Remember, guys, this is not planned. But yeah, I don't think that we are in any way, especially not now, bound to a confession of infernalism. And I said this before, I am not even the only one that said this. I think the overwhelming case in the Bible cannot support infernalism by virtue of the scriptures themselves. I would say that if you want to believe in something other than infernalism, if you want to believe, if you want to believe in something other than universalism or annihilationism, you're going to have to go outside of the scriptural corpus. I just think that it's that clear in the, in the history of the church. Where did I actually post this thing? So, I mean, you know, this whole issue of universalism is not that big of a deal anymore to me, in the sense that I've moved on, and I think that universalism is fairly obvious. I've just moved on to the next thing in my study of God's word. Let me just see. This is it. So yeah, I don't suppose that that you know anyone's gonna say anything that's gonna convince me of universalism. I mean, God's gonna have to speak pretty clearly for me to change my mind on this. I just don't think I'm gonna change my mind on this. And then again, there are many infernalists that are that probably aren't, you know. So, I mean, that's that. Anyways, it doesn't seem like I think I'm going to get this article, but you know. On to other things. I think it becomes fairly obvious to anyone that when they get into this discussion, that things are more complicated than people assume. But yeah, and that was something that else that I wanted to mention. Yeah, I'll just do another episode on the quotes that I wanted to read. But anyways, I didn't prepare for this recording anyway, so now I'm just speaking into the mic. Onto other things. Someone were, you know, I was there was this whole scandal with Father Peter Hears. Peter Hears. Now, I'm not gonna lie, I've never been a Father Peter Hears fan, but I find it incredibly disconcerting. This guy was pretty malicious in his attacks on the Eastern, you know, on the Roman Catholics, and Anglicans and Eastern Orthodox that don't agree with him. Now, people have asked me for some clarity. What do I mean by malicious? Well, he is completely aggressive. He's completely antagonistic. And he dismisses ipso facto any sacrament that happens outside of the Eastern Orthodox Church. Now, I'm not gonna lie to you. There's a point at which you need to decide whether you're going to pursue something. And you know, Father Peter Hears and all of his disciples, it's like speaking to a brick wall. There are people in the Orthodox world speaking about this, but like for the Father Peter Hears thing was something that happened recent enough for me to make a comment about it. And there was another YouTuber that was criticizing Archbishop Golitsyn, and apparently there was an article that was read, I'm not sure where, of this particular archbishop that defended Origen as being a saint. Now, I'm just gonna say this to everyone who doesn't know it already. I have two icons of Origen of Alexandria on my wall. I have one, a Coptic Orthodox icon, and I think it's Evagrius Ponticus and three other figures. I'm too far from it now, otherwise I would have read it, but that's on one of my cupboards, and I've got another Origen of Alexandria icon just you know at my desk, along with the other icons, as well as you know one of the other icons on my wall is a icon of Saint Maximus and Saint Isaac the Syrian. So yeah, I think yeah, that anyone who defends the sainthood or rehabilitates Origen, I would happen to agree with that. I don't agree with the condemnations lodged against Origen, and I don't think that the church has ever really, at least not directly, condemned Origen. And you know, this it's too messy for us to say that Origen's just the worst person in the world. There's a Father John Bear spoken on this issue. And yeah, I don't want to pursue that further, but I would just like to say the reason I am not that concerned about Father Peter Hears is that Father Peter Hears seems to believe. And I mean, he speaks about the fathers like all the fathers just agree with him. Those of you who don't know, this is something that you can check out. Even the Arians were not rebaptized. They were simply rechrismated. And it's interesting that Father Peter here has such a big deal, such a big issue with Christians who profess faith in Jesus. So, I mean, you know, this is technically the entire reason for my podcast, to defend the notion of ecumenism. And, you know, I don't know why this is such a big deal, but, you know, it tends to be a big deal for people who think the fathers seem to speak against it. And I don't think all the fathers do. I struggle to see that the history of the church reveals something that, you know, the fathers didn't believe. So the passage I wanted to read is kind of the way that I deal with this issue. My Ecumenist 101 text that I usually use when I think about this issue is Mark 9, verse 38 to 41. Teacher, said John, we saw someone driving out demons in your name, and we told him to stop because he was not one of us. Do not stop him, Jesus said, for one who does a miracle in my name can in the next moment say anything bad about me. For whoever is not against us is for us. Truly I tell you, anyone who gives you a cup of water in my name because you belong to the Messiah will certainly not lose their reward. So verse 39 and 40 is very interesting because Jesus says, do not stop him, Jesus said, for no one who does a miracle in my name can in the next moment say anything bad about me. Jesus is saying, and before that he says, because he, you know, they said that he was not of us. And Jesus says, for whoever is not against us is for us. It seems like what people who are against ecumenism is saying, what they are saying is this: we should stop fraternizing with Protestants, which is you should stop fraternizing with Roman Catholics because they don't believe the same teaching that we believe in and they are just anathema. Hopefully I can deal with this issue, and I'm going to be doing another episode of Father Gregory where we can kind of tackle this issue. But what I'd like to say to you is history is a lot more complicated than what most people care to admit. And this is something that even Father Peter Hears needs to admit. I've never been a fan of part of Father Peter Hears, but what I would say to people who are against baptisms that exist outside of the Eastern Orthodox Communion is that the schism is probably not as substantial as people themselves admit. Yes, there was a schism, but there is a substantial amount of debate on when the solidifying of the schism really happened. And up until after the schism, there was still a lot of intercommunal things taking place, people taking communion, you know, amongst themselves and stuff. I need to find the source. I'm not making this up. I just don't have the source offhand. Now, if I'm wrong about this, it wouldn't matter. In the sense that I think there are so many things about history that we need to be careful about before we make a dogma. The fact of the matter is the church has even rechrismated the Arians, and they were rank heretics. I'm not going to go further into that, but that's what I'd like to leave to you. So, yeah, I just wanted to create this episode just to make people know that I haven't abandoned ship. God willing, I will be continuing with my studies, and hopefully by the end of the year or sometime next year, I can finish up with everything that I need to finish up with. So yeah, thanks guys.